to this conversation. And yes, it's been too long. It's so good to see you. You all look wonderful. And I'm so happy to see your beautiful faces. So I am Hideko Serra. I am clinical psychologist by training, and I have been in the field of higher education for about 23, 24 years now. And after receiving a doctor of psychology, so my degree is PsyD as opposed to PhD, and after receiving PsyD degree as the first Japanese national to do so from the APA accredited program in the United States, I have worked for different sectors. So I have done education and training mostly of graduate students who are pursuing to become counseling psychologists, clinical psychologists, clinical mental health counselors, school counselors. And I have taught and then trained people for all this time. And I have also worked for different university settings. The most recent one is the one that I am at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, which is the only liberal arts college for Black men in the United States. And there are only three all-male, single-gender institutions in the United States: Wabash College, Hampton Snyder, and Morehouse College. And this is the only one for specifically dedicated to Black men in and also men of color, which has been in business since 1867. And we are the producer of the number one producer in the country that basically produces more number of Black men going into PhD, MD, and then also law school. So that's where I'm at.
Awesome, thank you so much. You guys feel free if you have any questions that pop up during the session, like, we have Dr. Serra for a limited time, so if y'all
Take your time. Take your time. I have blocked whole hour if necessary. Oh. So it's okay. It's okay.
Awesome.
Yeah, we don't have to talk fast.
Perfect. Okay, perfect. So you're at Morehouse. Can you walk us through a day that you go through at Morehouse, what your clinical responsibilities are, what your academic responsibilities are, and what that looks like for you?
Sure. So, you know, as you all have experienced, I mean, we are still at the heel of this whole pandemic thing. So to be honest with you, I have not been on campus that often. And all of my work has been done virtually. And what I do in the day-to-day stuff is that I don't necessarily see clients/students. So I work with seven other leaders within the student affairs, basically, one of whom is the director of counseling center. But I work with seven other kind of a critical core leaders within the student affairs to actually oversee all of the aspect about student well-being and then safety, as well as support and guidance. So I, my day-to-day stuff is filled with meetings. Not only that, I also, this is, by the way, this is an inaugural position. So no one has ever done this before. So I'm building it right now. And as you understand, you know, Morehouse being a HBCU, historically Black college and university, HBCUs don't necessarily have a person like me who works specifically on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And part of the reason for that is because HBCUs up to this point have struggled financially a lot of times, and they are just working on a tight budget, and yet, you know, punching above the class always. And what my job does, which is the Associate Dean of Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging, my job is supposed to infuse policies and practices to make sure that all components of college are done in an equitable and fair way. So anywhere from admissions all the way to graduation, to residential housing, to faculty hiring, all of those different components need to make sure that there are critical, you know, fairness and equity lenses that guide those decisions. So that is my job. So my day-to-day filled with meetings, filled with grant writings. I just got $30,000 from CDC to work on the HIV/AIDS prevention for our young men who are on campus, and then also destigmatizing process for students who get HIV/AIDS. So that kind of stuff. A lot of creative day-to-day building as you fly kind of things that are happening.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Sarah. I guess I would love to hear a little bit more about your credentials and what that process looked like for you. I know you kind of touched on it when you gave us a little background of your experience, but what did that process look like, getting your credentials and your PsyD, and then what did that look like in clinical practice? And thank you.
Sure. So the when you graduate with APA accredited program, when you graduate from APA accredited program, and by the way, American Psychological Association does not provide any accreditation for master's level. It's only for doctorate and then some postdoc, as well as pre-doc internship sites. So they accredit only very few, if you will, selected programs as well as selected internships sites. So when you go to a program like that, you basically are required for 5 years of education. So 4 years of all of the curricular and co-curricular stuff. And then the last year is the equivalency to the medical student's residency. So you basically are anywhere in the country, basically getting paid. Very small, but a stipend still, you get paid for a whole year, depending on the state and then their licensure board, because the licensing is controlled by state, by state, by state, and then also provincial for the Canada. So depending on which state that you go to, the requirements change a little bit, but most of the times before you go on this fifth year pre-doc internship, you are supposed to have about 3,000 hours under your belt. So people do 1 year of diagnostic / assessment, 1 year of therapy practicum. So those are two required practical years. And then most people do advanced practicum. And each time you are basically doing about 1,000 each. During the internship, the fifth year, you're supposed to do about 2,000 hours of clinical requirement in 1 year. And after you graduate, once you are done with everything, depending on states, for instance, in California, as well as Illinois, where I was at, you are supposed to do 2,000 hours more of postdoc before you can sit for licensure. So as you can see, it is a pretty rigorous way of making sure that people out there with clinical psychologist credential or the title know what they're supposed to be doing. And unlike a lot of other professions, once you get licensed in most states, you're required to do a CEUs, the continuing education units. So you are required to go through those things to keep your knowledge and skills fresh. So those are some of the basic stuff that I can share with you.
Speaking on some of the clinical work, what is your theory of choice, and what does that look like in your daily application?
That's right, because I didn't get to teach that class with you guys. Yeah. So my theoretical orientation is psychodynamic, but it is psychodynamic infused with a feminist and also CBT. So I was trained in CBT, and I have a certificate in CBT from a guy named Meichenbaum. So if you Google him, you will know that he's one of the CBT gurus. So I was trained by him. I also, within the psychodynamic, because I went to Adler University, I chose intentionally to go there because I was drawn by Adler's theory. So I consider myself very strong Adlerian. And I was trained by Harold Mozak and Bernie Shulman, who are two founding fathers of that university. And so, you know, CBT, psychodynamic, feminist perspectives, those are basically the kind of a, I don't know, a mixture of flavors that I like.
That's awesome. Well, I don't think we ever got to hear what your theoretical orientation was. It's always so social justice driven, which we were obsessed about. We still talk about it today. Like, we always text about you. But all right. To add to that, what does assessment look like for you? And especially you, driven from like from a psychodynamic, a feminist, and a CBT perspective, what does assessment intervention look like for you?
Gotcha. So there are two things I think that are critical for me when I think about assessment. One is that any good assessment is only a snapshot of what is happening at that time within that compound of factors that are impacting that person. So you can always look at the assessment as a snapshot, but it is never a permanent marker of that person, nor it is a 100% predictable nature of that person that you'll be able to garner. So it's a snapshot. The second piece is that any good psychological assessment has to be done in a battery. And when I say battery, I'm talking about there has to be an objective aspect. So for instance, Wechsler intelligence scale. So something that is very much measurable, and it has a good reliability, it has good validity. So there has to be an objective component, and there has to be also somewhat of a subjective but very informative pieces. For instance, like sentence completion, or house street person, or Rorschach ink blot test. Those are things that are considered subjective, but they have been tested many, many times. So those two, both of their components, objective and somewhat subjective, and different kinds of tests make up a battery. So no person should ever be assessed and determined of the tenet of that person or aptitude or abilities based off of just one battery or one instrument. It should be a battery of tests that would inform your decision about how you look at this person. And although I am a mixture of Adlerian feminist and, you know, CBT, that components of my theoretical framework does not go in when I do the assessment. When you do the assessment, you're supposed to be a blank. Your biases and all of that cannot enter that room because you are supposed to answer, and then there should be always an answerable question that you're working with. So if it is a court order, you know, client, and you have been asked by a court, is this person going to be, you know, engaged in dangerous behaviors again? Well, that is the question that you are supposed to answer. You're not supposed to go in there judging whether or not this person is a good person or bad person. There has to be an answerable, measurable question that you're working off of. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
That was the last of my questions. If anybody else has any more questions, I'm more gonna pop up as you keep on sharing, Dr. Sarah. So I appreciate you so much.
Sorry, this was a question. I don't know if you answered it, Dr. Sarah. Where are your degrees in? Like, what are your degrees in?
So my degree is in clinical psychology. So the biggest difference between clinical psychology and counseling psychology, by the way, APA, as I told you, only does the accreditation of doctoral programs, right? They only award accreditation to clinical psychology, counseling psychology, and school psychology. Those are the only three domains that APA gives accreditation to. So my area is in clinical psychology, which differs from counseling psychology with a basic tenet that the counselors or counseling psychologists tend to believe that there is abilities in every person that you are supposed to enhance that abilities. Clinical psychologists like me, on the other side, on the other hand, tend to focus on pathology. What is wrong with this person? That's the driving force of the field, as opposed to counseling psychologists tend to focus on what is right with this person. What can we do with this person? What are some of the abilities that have not been tapped in yet that we can enhance that person? As opposed to, we tend to be like zeroing in on what's wrong with people. So counseling psychologists don't necessarily like clinical people, and clinical people oftentimes think that the counseling psychologist, you know, as naive. And it's like, oh, this is a group of people who only see great things in people, and we focus on what's wrong with people. So those are like a kind of an easy breakdown.
Okay, so another question. I don't know if you touched it, if I missed it, because I just kind of got like engaged in the conversation. So when you did do your hours of like direct face-to-face, can you talk about like the agencies you worked at and what kind of clientele that you had?
Very good question. So the clients that I have seen and the kind of different agencies I have worked for halfway houses for men and women separately, of course, but men and women who have recently been released from prison systems, and they were basically re-entering into society. I have worked with children and adolescents who have been traumatized, PTSD, inner city kids. I have also worked in medical settings. I have worked in the emergency room. I have worked in the inpatient psych unit. I have also worked with NICU, the neonatal inpatient systems with preemies, the babies, and then not, of course, not directly working with the babies, but oftentimes the parents and then especially mothers who are just losing their, you know, mind over worrying about life and death situations of their children. So I have worked in hospital settings with these different populations, as well as acute rehab unit, and where I was along with few other trainees. We were doing assessment with inpatient, of course, oftentimes stroke and cardiovascular patients who come through the emergency room and their memories are not intact, their speech is, there is a deficit, and we try to find out exactly what is happening in terms of the outcome of their strokes or heart attacks. So those are specific people that I have worked with. And then the very important piece that I almost forgot, I also worked with people who are considered victims of torture. So there in Minnesota, there was a pretty well-known, internationally known agency called Center for Victims of Torture. And those are people who are refugees and asylees who flee their countries, and oftentimes women or sexual orientation minority people, so LGBTQIA people, who would get prosecuted if they were to stay there in their countries. So they flee, and many of them have experienced physical and then also emotional tortures while they were in their country or original countries. The center has opened up different several different branches, so it is expanding now, but that's another population that I have worked with.
That's awesome. I have a question. It's really great to see you, Dr. Sarah. We really miss you. Going to about more the equity that you work towards in the college that you work at, I was wondering if there's some sort of maybe not formal, or if it is formal, assessment of how you assess where they are at in terms of equity and diversity.
It's a really good question, and it's so good to see you. A lot of what is called DEI, so diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's a term that a lot of people use, not only in academia, but also in companies these days. A lot of DEI kind of initiatives and factors are oftentimes measured according to assessments that come out of companies. And they are oftentimes tied together to the headcounts. So for instance, the company says that we are committed to DEI. Well, let's see how many percentage, what's the percentage of your workers? How many of them come from this population, that population, that population? The problem with that it is that it doesn't really represent the true DEI. You basically are reducing people down to what is most salient about them, and then counting them as if each person basically are countable, qualifiable, when we are more than that. So the higher education DEI initiatives tend to focus on projects that basically push the policies and traditions forward, as opposed to trying to prove whether or not they are effective by counting things that is arbitrary. So that's the biggest difference between the company DEI and then a kind of a higher education focus of DEI. So I fall in the latter. So your question is so appreciated, because I think a lot of people then get really frustrated these days in higher education. Also, the DEI is a fluff. It's not a fluff, because what you're trying to promote is that regardless of your differences, we all want to make sure when people come to colleges or universities, they feel like they belong. Otherwise, we can't learn, and we can learn well. So trying to promote a sense of belonging, that's my job. And sometimes it is very hard to quantify it. And so that when I'm talking to business people within the college, they get frustrated with me too.
Thank you so much.
I have a question, Dr. Sarah. So what kind of inspired you to pursue a degree in clinical psychology, and kind of what, I guess, also inspired you to work in higher education?
It's a really good, great question. I was a competitive swimmer for a long time when I was growing up. I was pretty good, almost made it to the national team, and I wanted to study coaching. I saw growing up, I saw